This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on May 28th. Note that this was after the killing of George Floyd, but before the protests in Austin. Last week, the organization Human Rights Watch issued a report on release of prisoners worldwide due to COVID-19 and its prevalence in detention facilities. Based on a global media survey, available data indicate that the virus is spreading rapidly through jails and prisons, putting detainees, staff, and their families at unacceptable risk. Approximately 580,000 detainees from 80 countries have been authorized for release, although many of the release orders have not been fully carried out. This figure represents only about 5% of the estimated 11 million prison population. Many detainees have not been convicted of any crime and do not pose a security risk. Detainees are often at heightened risk of COVID-19 due to close proximity, inability to practice social distancing, a lack of adequate sanitation and hygiene, underlying medical conditions, and lack of adequate medical care. Staff risk exposure and infecting their own families and communities. In some countries, arrests for violations of curfews, quarantines, or other restrictions linked to the pandemic have actually added to the detainee population. Arresting people for violating COVID-19 emergency measures may increase disease transmission if the authorities place people in crowded detention facilities where the virus could easily spread. Human Rights Watch recommends screening and testing for COVID-19, providing adequate hygiene, sanitary conditions, and medical services, and reducing density to allow social distancing and to allow placing all who are ill and their close contacts in non-punitive isolation or quarantine with access to appropriate medical care. Joe Becker, an advocate director at Human Rights Watch, notes that governments need to move quickly to avoid disastrous consequences and massive loss of life. Releasing people who don't need to be in prison will not only protect incarcerated people, but staff and the broader communities as well. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Michael Barajas, staff writer for the Texas Observer. Michael covers civil rights issues for the Observer and lately has written several articles about Texas prisons. Good evening, Michael. How you doing?
I'm good. As good as I think anybody can be right now. Thanks for having me, Bob.
Yeah. This is your third time on the show. I think you broke a record with that. I don't think we've ever had anyone except Jim Harrington on here more than three times, you know?
Oh, wow. I feel honored.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about COVID-19 and prisons and but I just got to say, I've been listening to the news all day out of Minneapolis. It's really disturbing. You look at the pain of these people, and you know, how horrific that event must have been Monday evening. No wonder people are upset. And then I have to compare that with here in Austin back in April with Michael Ramos. And that still has not been resolved, you know, except for the bystander video. We haven't seen any of the body cam video. And we hear from APD is just coming out in kind of dribs and drabs. And I don't know what to make of it, I guess. Part of me is wondering why people in Austin aren't more upset about Michael Ramos.
Yeah. It's an equally troubling case, and another one caught on video. And I think, at least in the Ramos case, I can speak to having covered to some degree over the past few years, the Austin Police Department. People that listen to this show, I imagine, are familiar with Scott Henson and his, you know, widely read Grits for Breakfast blog. But I think he, as good as anybody else, recently had a good post on how this shooting that we saw with Mike Ramos really illustrates a lot of longstanding problems with the Austin Police Department, that people who want to reform the criminal legal system, people who are concerned about the continued data showing a disproportionate policing of Black and brown communities here in Austin, that are concerned about transparency when it comes to instances of police misconduct or police violence. This really brings a lot of those to the surface. I think that's why you've seen lately even more voices calling for Austin leaders to fire Chief Manley.
Well, I've not read Grits for Breakfast post, but just a few weeks ago, I did have Chaz Moore and Chris Harris on the show. It was an interesting evening, you know, given that I'm recording all this from home now because the co-op studios are still closed. We had a session with them, and Chaz was absolutely eloquent talking about the notion of public safety and just how the presence of police for Black people so many times diminishes public safety. And we finished recording, or we thought it was recording, and it turns out it wasn't. So we had to record the whole thing the following night. Chaz got on, we started off, and he said, well, let's see if we can make lightning strike again. Yeah, we're definitely watching that case. And you're absolutely right about APD. This year, there's been, well, that Tatum report.
Racism and other problems at that department.
Toxic atmosphere is the way it came across anyway. Mm-hmm. And then earlier in the year, OPO, Farrah Muscadin had her report. And apparently there's still another one pending out of the city at this point. And so, you know, I get it. I mean, I understand why they're calling for Manley's resignation or termination, whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, you've been writing quite a bit about prisons lately. Back in January, you were on, you had just written a piece about solitary confinement. Just going through your postings lately, going through the Texas Observer site, I noticed you've written quite a bit about the prisons, about COVID-19, especially the environment in the prisons right now. But then recently you just had a piece about visitation of families and whatnot. Why don't we start with COVID-19? I know you and I were texting back and forth earlier today, and you were correcting some of the numbers I had seen, or at least the numbers out of your article. And it sounds like it's not getting any better in prison.
Yeah, the picture is still emerging. Yeah, as you pointed out, I had recently done a big investigation into Texas's pretty extreme use of solitary confinement in the state prison system. And so there were a lot of other reporting that didn't necessarily go into that, but I'd been looking kind of up close at the prison system. And, you know, you mentioned the visitation story that we just published in the recent magazine as well about how easy it is for people to get blocked or banned from visiting loved ones behind bars. I mean, those were stories that I had been working on and sort of steeping in before the crisis struck. And so this pandemic has upended life for everyone to a certain degree. But I mean, it is an especially anxious time for, you know, the millions of people behind bars in this country and the many more millions of people, you know, who are their family members or their community or their loved ones. jails and prisons in Texas and across the country we've seen have emerged as hotspots for the virus, for this potentially deadly virus, for entirely predictable reasons.
On the news this afternoon, I believe it's a prison up in Abilene just became a hotspot. I don't know if you've heard that.
Yeah, I've been reporting a lot on the Texas prison system because of just the amount of cases that we're seeing and how many people are incarcerated in that system. But I mean, it's county jails as well. If you look at, I mean, this list keeps changing as the numbers come out and as the state of testing across the country isn't great. And so every other system is kind of a microcosm of that problem. But, you know, as you look at the list of the top 10, 20, 30, 50 hotspots across the country, there are correctional facilities all over that. And it should be stated, you know, not just correctional facilities. I mean, also workplaces, right? Like meatpacking plants. You know, I haven't been reporting on this so much, but some others at The Observer have on the concentration of cases there. And one thing that I try to stress in some of my reporting, and I think we've been trying to do at The Observer, and you've seen, I think, more of this coverage around the country, which is good, but these are institutions where people of color are overrepresented, where the virus has started to run rampant and where social distancing is impossible or next to impossible. So really dovetails with a lot of these larger concerns that really we should be thinking of about, you know, who is being impacted, who is being disproportionately impacted by the current crisis. And we're seeing that it's Black and Latinx communities, in particular African-American communities.
Right. We're actually, next week, my guest is going to be Paul Saldana, a former AISD school board member, but he is recently really taking up the cause of the disproportionate incidence of COVID-19 among Latinos here in Austin. So that's coming up next week. But yeah, you mentioned social distancing. These prisons are hardly country clubs, you know, and they're built to be very economic, I'm sure, and people are packed in there. It's funny, you know, we just had Gus Bova on a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about homelessness, you know, the irony of, well, everybody just needs to stay home, right? And now in, you know, talking about prisons, you know, well, we just need social distancing.
Yeah, I mean, what were the main sort of precautions that we were all urged to take early on? It was social distancing and just, you know, general hygiene. Wash your hands more than often. Wash your hands really well. You know, really good hygiene. And those are two things that are notoriously lacking in an incarcerated setting. Yeah, a lot of the situation is, of course, evolving inside prison systems as it is everywhere. You know, some of the earliest complaints were about that I was hearing from people inside and from their family members were just that those precautions that they were hearing on the news, that you might be hearing on TV, that all of us were urged to take, it was just impossible for them. I mean, it was almost like a joke, is the way some of them described to me. The sort of clumsy attempts to try to implement social distancing and some of those other precautionary steps in a lockdown facility. I mean, I heard a lot of stories of, you know, early on before some of these facilities went on lockdown that have COVID cases where, you know, not as many people would be brought into the chow hall at a time. They would be urged to sort of like make space at the tables and distance that way, but yet they were all crammed in line together to get food.
And if somebody does test positive, I guess they're put into medical isolation. Is that right? And what's that like?
Yeah, so I think that might vary depending on the unit, but one of the biggest complaints or at least concerns that I'm still hearing from people, not as much now that the prison system has started to do more mass testing in the past couple weeks, but, you know, early on, the conditions of like medical isolation were basically like solitary confinement in a lot of these facilities. And so you would have guys in, say, like a dormitory setting who, if one of them would come down with symptoms or, you know, that dry cough or the fever or any of the other symptoms that we've come to associate with COVID, there was a strong incentive not to report it. There was a strong incentive to hide it, either the fear that you could end up in medical isolation for 14 days without, you know, I've heard of people complain about not getting like blankets, you know, other people complain about a cup, like not even getting a cup to drink from. I mean, it can be pretty Spartan conditions. So yeah, that brings up the whole question of how how much of an undercount or how many of the cases were we really catching early on. But yeah, there was for a lot of people, they felt a strong, or they were telling me that they felt a strong disincentive to not report or not flag if they were feeling any symptoms. And then on the flip side, you know, I had some guys telling me that they felt like they had COVID symptoms and the correctional staff weren't taking it seriously. So there's also a flip side to that as well.
Yeah. Well, the one figure you had quoted in one of your articles was that approximately one third of the 140,000 incarcerated in TDCJ are on a lockdown right now. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I think the last numbers that I looked at were somewhere around probably, I think, like 38,000, 39,000 of the about, I think it's now around 136 or 137 incarcerated people in TDCJ. Okay. But yeah, hovering around that one out of every three number. That number will continue to fluctuate. I mean, I know a lot of families are really hoping that it goes down because of how hard it is to communicate with their loved ones when they're in a lockdown setting. Really early on in this crisis, as the facility started to go on lockdown, I was hearing from family members who were just beside themselves because it went from, you know, they would go visit them every weekend or every other weekend to the facility was on lockdown. They weren't getting letters or they were slow to get letters. And the people inside didn't even have phone access, so they weren't getting phone calls. So it really went to kind of a complete rupture in that line of communication for a lot of people. And you can understand that makes a lot of people really nervous when you see the case total start to grow behind bars. So in recent weeks, I've started to hear from family members and from people inside that they're getting these periodic 5-minute phone calls that prison officials have been promising the advocacy groups and family members. I'm still not entirely sure how uniform that practice is or how widespread it is across all of the facilities that are on lockdown, because some people told me a few weeks ago that they started getting those calls and that it was every day or that it was every other day or that it was a couple times a week. I just spoke to a woman who's in a story we're going to be publishing soon who hadn't heard from her husband in 5-6 weeks, was really worried, maybe got a couple letters, but on this past Monday just finally got a 5-minute phone call from him. And
wow.
And just imagine after all that time trying to pack everything you want to say into those 5 minutes. It's just, yeah, there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of tension, a lot of worry, a lot of concern.
Sure. And it's not just the prisoners either, right? I mean, you've got staff members who are testing positive and getting sick. And then you've also had several deaths, right? Both among prisoners and staff members.
So far, the best we know is that the prison system has reported, I think, at least 7 employees or staffers that have died with COVID. And I believe the latest number with incarcerated people is 36 or 37 at last count. But yeah, this is presented. I mean, you're right. It's not just people that are incarcerated in these facilities and their family members on the outside. It's also the people that have to work in them. And I and others have written about, you know, a lot of these, what the prison system is facing now under this crisis, it's kind of just like an exacerbated version of what they were already dealing with before. The staffing crunch in TDCJ, you know, for a long time, corrections officers have been saying they're pulling insane hours, working double shifts, having to bounce between units in a particular region, which pulls them away from their families because the staffing crunch in the Texas prison system has gotten so bad. What that's led to during a pandemic is corrections officers and other staffers even more afraid to be bouncing between those units because one might have COVID cases, another one might not. And you can imagine how that makes the people in their communities feel, how it makes their families feel. For a recent story, I spoke with he's the Texas corrections leader for AFSCME, for the basically the state correctional union head. And this was a big concern for him, in addition to just worrying about whether they had the proper protective equipment. And at the time, it was whether they were getting testing for all their staff. That has finally changed in the past couple weeks, but it took more than a month of the virus spreading behind bars for there really to be a plan for that kind of widespread testing.
Well, I guess the virus doesn't know the difference between the prisoners and the staff.
Yeah, and this has created some tension between, you know, local county officials who are dealing with their own issues in the community that have a lot of prisons. You've seen some flare-ups between the Brazoria County Judge, the Fort Bend County Judge, and prison officials as they started to transfer some incarcerated people that tested positive with COVID, you know, transferring them into units and basically in those officials' backyard without a whole lot of warning or communication, according to those officials. And I mean, it's been interesting for me to see because I know I covered the prison system before this, you know, I covered the prison system during the last legislative session. And one of the big hopes among criminal justice reformers and prison reformers was that there would be some sort of independent system of oversight for the Texas prison, for the Texas Prison Agency, largely because, you know, the feeling that a lot of problems, if left unchecked, or if, you know, you leave management or you know, prison administrators to fix them themselves, that they can turn into crises and create a risk for incarcerated people and people that work in prisons and for their families. Now you have officials on the outside saying that the lack of transparency by TDCJ is causing a public health concern and a possible risk to the public. So I'm very curious to see how what's happening in the prison system now, whether any of that translates into sort of a different discussion when lawmakers go back into session.
You know, a few weeks ago, we had Amanda Woog on talking about bail reform and got into that whole issue about Abbott's executive order basically quashing local judicial authority when the sheriffs were desperately trying to reduce their jail populations. And now we've got something analogous going on at the Texas prison level. One of the figures I think I read in your piece was that of this 137,000 incarcerated?
Yeah, 136, 137, I think is the last number I looked at. A lot of, that might be due to them just taking fewer people from county jails at the moment. Yeah, that's right.
But you said 77,000 are eligible for parole. Did I read that right?
That's correct. Yeah. That have reached the date where they're parole eligible. Yeah.
That's more than half. I mean, it boggles the mind thinking about the situation we're in with this pandemic, that we've got all these people eligible for parole and they're still hanging on to them.
And there's even a subset of that number. I mean, there's the 77,000 that are eligible for parole. It looks like, according to the latest data, that there are about another 15,000 that have been approved, that have made parole, that have been approved by the parole board. It looks like about 10, 11,000 of those people are waiting for counseling or substance abuse classes or these other pre-release programs that the parole board requires them to finish. I mean, these are people that the parole board has like taken. So those 77,000 people, they've been denied by the parole board, even though, you know, they're eligible for whatever reason. And that's a whole other discussion for a whole other day when it comes to parole reform. But advocates have really been focusing on this other subset as well of people that have been approved for release and are still behind bars. The argument there has been that, you know, those are classes or programs that they could be taking on the outside, at least some of them, reduce the prison population, which, you know, experts say is the best way to reduce the spread of the virus behind bars. That seems like an easy place to start, is I think the easiest place to start.
Yeah, people are attending AA meetings online, you know, and I'm sure these classes could be offered online, you know, or...
Well, some of the people in facilities that are in lockdown have said that their classes have essentially turned into just correspondence work, like workbook packets in their cell, which then the argument is very much, why couldn't you just do a workbook packet on the outside? There was actually a rally Memorial Day weekend on that Saturday. It was interesting. There was an Open Up Texas, almost like anti-vaxxer looking rally at the Capitol. But if you just like looked across the lawn, there were a bunch of families of incarcerated people social distancing with masks on, but holding signs with photos of their family members, of their loved ones in prison that were eligible for parole or had already been approved, just outside the governor's mansion, just kind of begging for Governor Abbott's attention on this front. So far, he has signaled no willingness to consider prison releases in the same way other states have.
We're speaking with Michael Barajas, staff writer for the Texas Observer, about Texas prisons in the time of COVID-19. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on May 28th. We're speaking with Michael Barajas, staff writer for the Texas Observer. Let's continue. A little more about just what the reality is inside. We've got this whole mantra about stay home, wash your hands, limit contact, social distance. And yet it sounds like inside the prison, they can't even get hand sanitizer and protective equipment and lack of cleaning supplies. And the list just goes on.
Yeah, that's been the issue in a lawsuit that was filed by a couple elderly inmates at the PAC unit, which is a geriatric prison out near Navasota, which in prison reform circles has been kind of famous because these were some of the same prisoners, this was the same unit, and some of the same civil rights attorneys that are helping them that brought this game-changing lawsuit over deadly, you know, heat in uncooled prisons during the summers that forced at least some mild reforms by the Texas prison system that they're still kind of fighting in court. But no, this most recent lawsuit was over basic protections like access to hand sanitizer wherever possible and basic cleaning supplies and making sure, you know, inmate janitors didn't have to share gloves with each other when they were wiping down surfaces and cleaning the units and toilets. And yeah, just some of the basic issues that we talked about before, lack of hygiene, lack of sanitation, and lack of social distancing. The people incarcerated in that prison and the lawyers that represent them, I mean, they say that the precautions TDCJ has taken are grossly inadequate anyway. But even on top of that, they're not even, those inadequate precautions have not been followed anyway. There was actually just today a hearing that's going up through the, you know, federal appeals court. It went to the sort of notoriously conservative Fifth Circuit today. It's unclear where that's going. But yeah, the Texas prison system is fighting, relaxing its prohibition on hand sanitizer, taking that all the way to the top federal appeal courts.
And then on top of all this, there's some transfers of prisoners going on. What's that about?
So the transfers that I've seen most have been for medical reasons. So the state prison system has largely shut down any, like, what they call unnecessary transfers. So what you've seen the most of are people that would be tested positive for COVID that were moved to facilities that were closer to the prison hospital in Galveston. That's what caused a lot of the, I guess you would say, the clash between officials out in, like, Brazoria and Fort Bend, because they saw COVID positive prisoners being moved into their backyard. They claim, again, without notice. I think TDCJ contests that. But one of them, I think it was the Fort Bend County judge, if memory serves, that even sent, you know, like a letter to the state lawmakers, you know, saying TDCJ needs new leadership. Those medical transfers have caused some strife with local officials. And then on the flip side, you know, a lot of movement has stopped. And so one thing that I've found is, you know, speaking of this, the 10,000 incarcerated people that are just, you know, have been approved by the parole board that are waiting for programs that they need to finish to get out. You know, the way that system worked already was aggravating for a lot of people. You would get, I recently wrote about, I should publish soon, some people who were, say, approved for parole on, like, drug charges back in November or December. The parole board already told them they had to wait until February or March for whatever reason to start those programs. So it's a 6-month program. The clock doesn't start ticking until three or four months after the parole board has already, you know, approved you for release contingent upon that program. And then what happened with the pandemic is, you know, about around mid-March, a lot of unnecessary transfers got stopped. So inmates weren't being transferred to various units to start those programs. So, you know, I found a handful of people where they're supposed to start that, like, 6-month countdown to release back in February or March, but it's not clear now when that's going to happen. And as you can imagine, those prisoners and the families and communities connected to them are very worried about them having to spend any extra months behind bars. I mean, they would have been worried about that already, but of course they're even more worried now. So on the flip side, you know, those transfers that have stopped, I think, have been have led to some problems.
I don't know enough about TDCJ, but are some of the prisons or some percentage of the prisons run by private prison corporations, or are these all state employees?
So I think there are a couple units that are privately operated. Some of the programs that are run in some of the prisons are operated by private contractors. In the state prison system, no, you don't see as much privatization with like a private prison company that either owns or leases out the whole facility and runs it with their own, you know, hired correctional staff like you do in, say, immigrant detention. But you still have private contractors all along the way, whether it be in, you know, release programming or in rehabilitative programming, services to the phones and approved card carriers that people are allowed to, that families are allowed to use to send loved ones cards now. So it's, there's still private contractors all kind of all along that route, even if it's not a private prison company running the show.
Yeah, I guess, you know, thinking about immigration detention facilities, what Jim Harrington would say, quit calling them that, they're prisons. But, and he would know. I mean, he's done quite a bit of work up at the Don Hutto facility up in Taylor there. But, you know, whenever I hear about private contractors, I always wonder about, you know, what's the motivation or the conflict of interest, I should say, you know, in terms of releasing people and keeping them there. I'm guessing that some of these facilities are paid by the detainee. Anyway, transitioning a little bit, you've made several references to family visits and whatnot, and that's the subject of maybe your most recent article, a published article. Do you want to tell us a little about what's going on there?
Yeah, so that story, which is out in our May magazine that published there, it's one that I'd started working on before the current crisis. But I mean, it's something that I've been hearing about for a while, which is families saying that Texas prison officials had banned them from seeing loved ones over what they considered to be petty or confusing or unproven claims of misconduct. And so I started digging into that system. And what I found was, yeah, that it's really easy for prison officials to kick somebody off of a visitation list for months and or years and to never really have to justify it or even provide some sort of route, you know, back on to the list if there was some issue of misconduct or broken rules. Or really, it seems to run the gamut from an allegation of, you know, attempting to bring in contraband to, there's one woman whose story I detail in here where it really just seems to be like a misunderstanding that like snowballed and just got blown out of proportion. The more she tried to fix it, that got her kicked off her husband's list and now she can't see him. To another couple that I talk about, her and her husband, I think, were on the prison issue phone lines and they were just like talking about the latest scuttlebutt or something, which was, you know, they claim it was a corrections officer that was helping, you know, bring cigarettes or some other contraband into the prison. And because they discussed it on the phone line, that got flagged and again snowballed into this issue where even though no contraband was found, the loved one was certainly never charged or accused of anything serious, never formally. But now she can't see her husband and neither can her kids as often. International standards for like the treatments of prisoners really consider prison visits to be a human right. So it's a lot harder to disrupt them in that way. Or there is a legitimate security reason to disrupt, you know, to provide some other route of communication or a way to restore that connection, you know, just cut it off. And there are reasons for that. I mean, visitation is a critical lifeline for incarcerated people. There are studies, there's research that shows that visits from loved ones can help maintain and really strengthen positive social bonds that both prevent criminal behavior behind bars and can help prevent it after incarceration. You know, I think what's actually happening in the prison system right now kind of makes the issue even maybe a little bit more relevant because, you know, now all visitation has been halted because of the COVID crisis. Since mid-March, families and others haven't been allowed to go to see loved ones. And I think for understandable reasons. I mean, I know it was a little bit controversial, but some of the inmate family groups and advocates wanted visitation to be cut off when it was, because they were afraid of people bringing the virus in and making the situation worse and it spreading like wildfire because of all the reasons that we just discussed. Problem is that there was nothing to help sort of like keep and foster those connections with the lack of in-person visitation. No use of tablets or video visits so people can still connect with loved ones that way. As I talked about before, even the phone situation, people weren't even getting phone calls for weeks to more than a month. So even before this crisis, it was really easy for loved ones to be basically shut out for a variety of reasons that I detail in the story. But pandemic can be another one. You know, a virus spreading behind bars can be another reason visitation might be stopped. But there's no system in place to maintain those connections, to make sure the loved ones can still communicate like they should be able to. In a lot of cases, it's just a complete disruption. And as I detail in the story, that, as anybody I think can imagine, that can cause an enormous amount of strife. It can be detrimental to somebody's rehabilitation in some cases. It can be damaging for the health and well-being of mothers and sisters and children on the outside. For me, it was another one of those issues where it highlights how, I mean, it's not just the incarcerated person behind bars, but the whole constellation of connections and loved ones and communities that they belong to that are impacted by how prisons operate and what they can do with relative impunity, right? Without a whole lot of oversight, without really a whole lot of justification or explanation. For some of these families that have been cut off for a long time, it had been years, and they keep appealing to get back on their list, and the only explanation they ever get, and I saw dozens of these letters. It's just a perfunctory, like, five-sentence letter from this appeal board inside the prison system that literally just gives them the same five rote boilerplate sentences every time they appeal to get back on. I think a lot of people don't know what to do. They feel like they have nowhere to turn.
You know, even if you ignore the obvious psychological and emotional effects, you know, the humane side of this question. If you just think about what is going to be best for the prison, what's going to be best for society, all the way down the line, I just can't imagine that any of this makes sense in the bigger picture.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that, and I had written about this some earlier this year, it was another reason that kind of got me to look into visitation policies a little bit deeper, but these visitation restrictions are getting kicked off the list. That took on a little bit more urgency early this year because the state prison officials passed new rules that, I mean, it looks like could make it easier to block people from visiting loved ones in the future. There were new rules that like banned greeting cards. That's why I mentioned the third party card carriers, because you can't even like send greeting cards to loved ones behind bars anymore. You kind of have to go through an approved vendor. These new policies expanded drug sniffing dog searches for visitors aimed at cracking down on contraband. And that's kind of despite the dubious reliability of drug canines that we know. And that's also, even though, I mean, Carrie Blakinger at the Marshall Project had a really good story before all this that pointed out how really a lot of the allegations are against corrections officers and prison staff bringing in illicit goods and contraband. I heard stories from people who, like, a drug dog alerted on their car. They kind of got worried there would be like a more invasive or strip search after the car got searched itself, and they just kind of asked if they could leave, and then they got kicked off the list. They weren't allowed, like, even though no drugs were found.
It all sounds very arbitrary, to say the least.
Well, and that's kind of a theme if you remember our discussion when we talked about solitary confinement. I mean, the question there was, even if there was a legitimate security concern for, you know, isolating somebody early on, why would they still be in the hole 30 years later when they're in their 80s? And it's because that appeal process just broke down. I mean, there was just, or at least from the outside, it appeared that way because it just seemed sort of perfunctory. You appeal every 6 months and you get the same answer. No real consideration of the individual sort of circumstances.
Let's switch one more time here. I want to ask you a little about an earlier article you wrote regarding the dismantling of the Office of Minority Health Statistics and Engagement. Can you tell us a little about the history of that and what the fate of that was?
Sure. So Texas actually had a state office that really the point of it was to investigate racial disparities in state services, or disparities in outcomes for people utilizing state services. And this office kind of started in the child welfare system back around like 2005, because the numbers were starting to show that CPS was far more likely to remove children from Black parents than from white parents, and was less likely to offer services to Black and Native American families, you know, all else being equal. And so that work kind of ballooned from there. You know, eventually the people leading that would form this office within the state healthcare network called the Center for Elimination of Disproportionality and Disparities, which I think was a little bit more explicit. But yeah, it was to interrogate a lot of the disparities that I think are making headlines now, because, you know, the COVID crisis has kind of laid bare what many of those are that preceded the pandemic, like Black and Latinx communities having higher rates of chronic illnesses like diabetes and hypertension, and also having far higher like uninsured rates than their white counterparts. What's so strange about when this office actually got eliminated was it was back in 2017 session, right around the time that Democrats in the legislature were pushing for some reforms, because they were really alarmed by all this new data that was showing Black women dying of pregnancy-related causes at far higher rates than their counterparts. And so amid all of that is when the legislature quietly defunded this office. The justification I was given was, you know, it was during a budget crunch. Obviously, that kind of work seems more important now more than ever. We need those types of disparities to be investigated and interrogated. And that's why I think you hear lawmakers like Donna Howard and some others saying that they want to try to bring it back in the next session, that the pandemic has really shown why we need it.
Well, we can hope, I guess. Who knows what's going to happen next year during the legislative session. But, well, gee, that's a lot there, Michael. Any closing thoughts? I mean, are you hopeful at all about what you've seen? Any reason for hope? You see any positive trends coming out of all this? It all sounds pretty bleak listening to you talk.
No, I mean, I think this is just, I mean, this is not unique analysis, but this has just exposed and highlighted to a really large extent. This crisis has exposed and highlighted so many problems that preceded it. And I think the good thing is, or the silver lining could be, I guess I should say, that, you know, you have more people and more public officials, I think, paying attention to some of these problems. You know, we were talking about prisons and jails, but on the jail front, you've seen judges and sheriffs and local officials in some jurisdictions, Greg Abbott and Ken Paxton aside, trying to do what they could to expedite the release of pretrial detainees that did not need to be in jail, that shouldn't be in jail. I mean, you almost saw like more allies sort of emerge in this effort to decarcerate the state because the stakes had become so high, or had become so obvious, maybe is a better way to put it. I mean, going back to this, the state office to interrogate disparities in state services, the legislature's talking about bringing that back now. On the prison front, I've had a lot of conversations with both advocates, but also lawmakers about, does this mean there will be a greater push for independent oversight of the prison system come 2021 session, the next legislative session, because of everything that we're seeing, you know, how the prison system has responded to the crisis, some of the problems that we've seen sort of become worsened by it, some of these flare-ups between local officials and prison officials over how transparent or how much they have to say about what they're doing. Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity if we keep paying attention, if there's enough pressure on lawmakers to do what they say they want to do during the crisis, if there's enough pressure on them, you know, when they go back into session. I guess we'll see. But yeah, I think there are silver linings, or I think there are opportunities, right? There are opportunities to look for beyond all the pain and hurt and anxiety that we're seeing because of all this.
Well, and thanks in no small part to the efforts of people like you who are calling everyone's attention to this as well. Really appreciate your efforts and appreciate your joining us here this evening to tell us about what you've seen, what you've learned here recently.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks for amplifying these issues. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's all for this evening. Please join us next week when Paul Saldana will join us to talk about disparities in the incidence of COVID-19 in the Latinx community here in Austin. Stay tuned for Roots Train with Dale Smith coming up next. A quick note from the Community Council at Co-op. We want to know how you're faring through the COVID-19 crisis. If you have questions about community resources, or if you'd just like to share a story about people doing good work, you can leave us a message by emailing covid19@koop.org, or you can call or text 512-710-5353. A member of our community council will get back to you. That's COVID-19, COVID-19, at coop.org, or 512-710-5353 for Co-op's COVID-19 community response line. Thank you.